All right, welcome to day two, a little more than halfway through. Right now, what I would like to talk to you about is a culture of error. We're going to talk about kind of the classroom and some things that happen along the way when you're teaching this curriculum or pretty much any computer science curriculum that you do. The first thing that we want to talk about is the notion of being a teacher. And one of the hardest things that you're going to deal with is the thought of, I taught it, they learned it. Right? Because you kind of, as you work through your day as a teacher, you know, first period, second period, third period, you kind of get into a flow and you think, okay, I just put in 42 minutes worth of time and everybody's good. We're good to go. And you kind of have to step back for a second and realize that of 42 minutes of time, if you have 30 students, which is probably a lot, I think the most that I ever had in a class was 28, but say you have 30 students and you're teaching for 42 minutes and you assume that everybody has learned all the material, but maybe you had only five or six that were able to follow you all the way through for 42 minutes. Maybe you had 10 that after 30 minutes of your time teaching, they kind of trailed off and started doing something else. And maybe you had a few that, were with you for about 5 minutes and then start playing a game or something of that nature. Then you do have students that won't be in the classroom and you have to get them caught up. So you have to always mentally think like, how can I assure that the students are actually grasping this material? So the challenges that you're going to come up against are situations, the fact that computer science is a compounding curriculum, the material builds on itself. So it's not the same as maybe if you're teaching history, where if you teach World War I and somebody doesn't really have an interest in it, they can kind of tune you out. Unfortunately, that happens. Or maybe throughout a World War I session, there's just a student that's not there because they're out for any purpose, a leave, a vacation, or something like that. But they can come back, and when you talk about World War II, they can pick it up and they can know every date and every battle, et cetera, et cetera. And they can move through the curriculum with you for the rest of the year. But computer science, you kind of have to keep everybody with you every step of the way. And that's something that is the most challenging with your students, to ensure that everybody's kind of on par as you move through the curriculum. Another challenge you're going to have is the difference between a student's understanding in a theoretical perspective and a practical perspective. A student, if you're teaching loops or something of that nature, maybe a student can stand up in front of the classroom and explain fully. A loop is something that'll, you know, minimize steps. I don't have to say, if I want to create a square, you know, move so far, turn, move so far, turn, move so far, turn. I can just create one step where I can say, move so far, turn, and I can repeat that four times. That's great. The student will understand the theoretical perspective, but then you say, you know, maybe sit down and write it, and they get in front of a keyboard and they're not really sure where to go from there. So that's another challenge you're going to have to overcome, is being able to decide if the student does have that theoretical grasp of it, they can repeat it back to you, but you have to also be aware of, you know, their abilities to actually write out that code. Another scenario is, you know, there's many ways to solve a problem. And I think this is not necessarily a challenge for the negative, but maybe for the positive, because that's kind of where a lot of learning happens. Even as a teacher, you know, I taught Word, Excel, PowerPoint, but even when I was first teaching, the first year that I taught Word, Excel, PowerPoint, as I told you, but I used Excel extensively in my career prior to that. So, you know, I was very fluent in it. I knew a lot of things, but you'd be amazed that the things that a seventh grader could teach you after X amount of years of thinking that you've mastered Excel. You know, I would teach a student a certain way to do something, and immediately I would teach them, and then they would say, "Ooh, what if you do this?" And I'd say, "I'd never known that. I've been working with this tool for, you know, 10, 15 years, and I never knew you could do that." So there, you always have to look out for, you know, not only correct ways, but more efficient ways, and encourage the students to always be striving for, you know, the more efficient or the better, most optimal way to do something. So strategies, as we all know, is going to be to ask questions frequently. Just always, like, you know, going around the class, how do you feel about this? Where do you stand here, et cetera, et cetera. Practice problems is going to be a great way to engage students. We had introduced to you the sandbox. David had done a demonstration. That's a great way to kind of get the students working. Plus, we also give you a more broad list of piece sets. We give you the piece sets that we have in the course at the collegiate level, but then, as you saw when I did my presentation yesterday, there's so much more smaller piece sets to kind of keep the students moving along in between the larger piece sets. Resources to help reinforce concepts and refresh memory. You know, the CS50 reference that we had talked about, where you can actually print out like manual pages or students can refer to them online. That's a great resource, or you can go into any kind of documentation. They can watch the shorts, they can watch walkthroughs, they can go back and utilize any of those things, and that will kind of keep them moving along. And again, printing out using Render 50, whether you're gonna print out the piece that they're working on and things of that nature, that could assist you with the accessibility issue we had talked about. If a student doesn't have access to internet at home, or even if they don't even have a physical computer at home, they can actually print out their code via Render 50, and they can take that with them and still have a way to access the content. So here's a great one. Using both non-code and code examples. Obviously, code examples are self-explanatory, but non-code, like this is fantastic. We actually have a teacher. It's the same teacher that's in Ohio that I told you about that we go and visit for her fair. She actually videotaped her students doing a peanut butter challenge or a peanut butter pseudocode scenario, and it was hilarious. She sent it, this was probably 2 years ago, but I had seen it. It was really funny. Her students really exaggerated. I think the one point it was something like lift the peanut butter off the table, and you know, the student threw it all the way across the room, and it got a little dangerous for her a little bit, but it's great because it's one of the hardest things about teaching computer science, as I'm sure you know, is to get the students to get some kind of tangibility about it. Like they're always typing code and it lives in this invisible world that they don't really know what's going on. They're just typing words on a screen and something's happening somewhere. But whenever you actually like put something tangible in their hands, it really brings it back and it emphasizes what they're really doing, and they can wrap their head around it that way. Here's a great one. This is what I used to always do. Before revealing the answer, always ask for multiple answers. So for example, when I taught, and everybody has their own teaching style, but what I would like to do is I would ask a question, and let's say the answer was 3 for whatever reason. If I had a student immediately say 3, and then I had another student say 2, what I would always do is I would go to the student that said 2, and I would say, all right, great, how did you arrive at 2? And then I would listen to them, and I would listen to what they're saying, and I would kind of lead them almost to the point where it was proving that the answer was wrong, but I didn't want to like prove to them that they were wrong. I just wanted to see what their thought process was, because sometimes a student is like almost there and they just need to connect the last dot, right? And then what I would do is I would go back, and then I would, before even revealing that the answer was 3, I would go to the student that had 3 and I would say, how did you get to 3? So we would kind of like compare and see just the thought process of what was going on and how you came to your solution. And a lot of times you'll get a student that that if they're connecting that last thought, maybe they're, like I said, they're right there. And then once you compare the two, they'll see from the other student, maybe like the way that I'm explaining it isn't 100% crystal clear, like they're 99% crystal clear, but then because the other student kind of gets them over the hump, it helps them, and then they themselves will pick it up. So here's a great one. After showing the answer, ask for alternative solutions. Students love this. Like same scenario, I was telling you, like if I show a student something when I was doing Excel and I thought I knew everything about it and the hand would go up. If you show a student a right answer and then you say like, what's another way to go about this? They're gonna love the opportunity to kind of show you, what they know above and beyond what you've already taught them. So that is always a great strategy. Not just coming to a conclusion and then moving on, but coming to a conclusion and saying like, what else can we do here? And then obviously you want to discuss the trade-offs. If a student have the same answer, this would maybe be a design scenario. They both have the right answer, but you want to see why. Why do you think this is more efficient? Why would you use this opposed to this and whatnot? Another great thing that you could do in your class to kind of bring the sense of community to students is creating a culture of error. Nobody? There you go. That's an oldie. That's been around for a while. But yeah, so creating a culture of error for your students. So here's a good example. Those of you that were here last year, or if you had watched the video from last year when Doug had given this presentation, Doug Lloyd, the senior preceptor, if he had given this presentation, or if you had seen him do this on any other videos, he likes to tell a story about when he was a freshman. I don't want to destroy the story, I just want to give the kind of general overview. He was taking a math course and he went to office hours to get assistance from the professor. And it was something like he was working really hard on a piece set in the math course, and he just like wasn't quite arriving where he wanted to be with the solution, and the professor was working with him. And another student came in that was like far more advanced, and the professor went to work with that student and looked at Doug and said, he understands it, why don't you, right? And that really affected Doug. He never went to office hours again. So it just shows you, like, as a teacher, the impact that you can have on a student by the way that you discuss something with them. So it has nothing to do with Doug's love of math or something. It was just kind of way the teacher approached it. So I don't have a story like that myself, but I have a really funny story. I think it's funny. I hope you think it's funny. Kind of a similar scenario. I had an English teacher years and years and years ago who, when she was working on her PhD in English, she had a professor that made her read Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening by Robert Frost. And it has to do with a gentleman riding a horse in the woods and it's snowing and things of this nature, right? So she had to do some kind of analysis on it and say what this poem meant, why, and she turned it in and she ended up getting a C. And it was like the only C that she'd ever gotten in her life. So she went to the professor and said, what did I do wrong here? And the professor was like, can't you see that the snow means death and this means that? And she was just, you know, my teacher was just kind of like, I couldn't believe it, right? So she was just really burnt by this, my teacher was, because of the way that her professor treated her. Well, years later, my teacher had the opportunity to meet Robert Frost before he passed away, and it was like a book signing or something, and she had him sign whatever, and she said, I just have to ask you a question. She said, when I was getting my PhD, this is what my professor said, that I was wrong because the snow meant death, and I didn't see that, and this, and she listed out this whole thing, and Robert Frost looked at her, he goes, really? So I thought that was just about a gentleman riding a horse in the woods in the snow. So she literally got it from the horse's mouth that, you know, this professor that you know, had given her such a heck before, she was wrong, right? But for all those years, it had bothered her. So creating a culture of error, it's okay to struggle. We know this, right? It's okay for the students to struggle because that's how you thrive. It's okay to be wrong. If you're never wrong, then why am I teaching you? If I can walk into a class and for the first time teach you something and you're done, you're good, you're perfect, then I'm obviously not challenging you, right? That's not computer science, that's not CS with the AP or AP CSP, that's just education in general. If you're never wrong, I'm not challenging you enough. Error is respected. I love whenever a student is wrong and they think they're right and they're like, I'm almost there. And then you sit there and you work through the problem with them and you say like, and you never say like you're wrong or you never use those words like you know, this isn't correct. It's just like let's get a little bit further. Let's move a little bit further. You know, how can we twist this? How can we? And that's where you know, the best learning has happened, I think, is whenever you find ways that you're doing something wrong and then you find the way that it's right and you think like, wow, like now I understand why. So error is normal. And error can be learned from, as I said. So Thomas Edison, one of the most famous quotes that he ever had was, it took him over 1,000 times to invent the light bulb, right? And somebody had asked him one time, and to paraphrase, they said, like, how did it feel to fail 1,000 times? And his response, rather than being like, oh, I was upset about it or whatnot, he didn't say that. He said, I didn't fail 1,000 times. I found 1,000 ways not to make a light bulb. Right? And that's true. So error can definitely be learned from. All right. So here is something else that we like to address. Just the saying, like, does anybody have any questions? Does anybody have any questions? If you say that to a group of students, what do you think that their likelihood that they're going to raise their hand would be? It's probably a lot less than if you phrase the question a little bit differently, because saying, you know, does anybody have any questions is kind of like, do you have a question? And you kind of feel on the spot, even if I'm not directly asking you, you kind of feel on the spot, so you're not going to put yourself in that situation. So maybe you could address the students to, what questions do we have? Kind of open the floor. It's open. Everybody asks, what do we got? Any questions? Anybody ask me a question, right? So what other ideas are there out there? Just, I want to start like any kind of like discussion here. Does anybody have any thought, any issues that you've run into? I'm sure you have. Any ways that you've addressed the situation or helped a student or seen a student that was like really struggling and then you overcame something? Anybody?
I don't know if this might be off task, so you can stop me.
But how about the kids that aren't doing their, aren't working enough outside class?
Like a matter of motivation to do things outside of class, or?
And so they're falling behind. And what kind of questions do we use to draw them out?
Oh, no, totally fine. I would say, you know, a lot of times what I had found when I was teaching is that if I was teaching middle school too, so students are like on lockdown, they're not going to tell you what their feelings truly are. They're just going to kind of do what they want and let you leave, let you guess what's going on. What I found is that, you know, the best approach there is to kind of like to get to know what's going on. If you have a student that for no reason in particular is just dropping the ball, they're never doing homework, they're showing up late, they're skipping class and things, you know, then you would want to, if you've already talked with the student, and the student's really not giving you anything, they're just kind of saying like, I just don't want to do it or whatnot, but you know that they're intelligent enough to do it, then, you know, maybe I would go and see the counselor and say like, hey, is there anything that we need to be aware of here? What's happening? Because you'd be amazed. I was naive when I first started. I worked in a district that was extremely diverse, not like racially or anything like that. It was financially diverse. I had students that were homeless and I had students that lived in multi-million dollar homes and everything in between. So you kind of didn't know what was going on in a student's life as to whether or not like their parents were married or divorced, or if it was a bad situation, a good situation, because, you know, even with divorce, you don't know. It could be a fantastic situation. Maybe everybody gets along and it's great. So you can never assume anything, but I was kind of naive to, I just would assume, I would see the student in the classroom and I would say, you're here, why are you not performing? And then it wouldn't be until I found out like layers later that there was something happening elsewhere that was affecting that. So it could be any number of things. Maybe the student, you know, a lot of things that are happening today, or you figure like sports. So students are playing multiple sports. I had a student that slept in class all the time. And, you know, I would get really aggravated and I would say, why are you, and she's a brilliant girl, why are you sleeping in my class all the time? And it turns out that she was on, you know, like X amount of traveling softball teams and traveling, you know, volleyball teams, and every Friday her parents would pick her up and they would travel two states away and they would get back just this Sunday night for her to sleep and come to school. And, you know, it's just, so you never know. I think that if you think that things are outside of school are the hindrance, you know, maybe there's something that's another layer there, especially if it's a bright student, because there's really no reason why, I would assume, you know, but that's my thought, purely my thought. Anyone else? Yes,
well,
Derek.
I was thinking the way what can be kind of hard is the troubleshooting aspect. They kind of want you to go through and figure out what's wrong. And that can be a struggle because I think probably, you know, their age, that they don't appreciate the learning that you have when you're troubleshooting. I mean, I have to tell them that, you know, troubleshooting is the learning process, but
right,
they still want you to come over whenever the things don't work out. But they want you to figure it out.
Right.
Which I tell them it's kind of hard because I didn't write any of this.
Yeah. So like maybe to address something like that, if you're writing code or something, like commenting would have to be, you know, if they want you to come over and look at 50 lines of code and say what's wrong, you know, obviously commenting things out every few lines or every, you know, section of code or whatnot would definitely help you, because then you could at least understand why, maybe, or that would give you a better starting point to address their question. I would assume. Anyone else? Yes.
Just going to creating a culture of error, one of the things I've done at the beginning, I tell them, I keep a box of dum-dums, those little lollipops, and if I make a mistake, I say 2 and 2 is 5, or I misspell something on the board, and they respectfully point it out. They earn a dum-dum and they can eat it right then and there in the middle of the class. So, that's great. That's okay to make.
Yeah, do you like over top and say like, I am a dum-dum, here's your dum-dum, or anything like that? Yeah, you gotta get the...
Oh, good for you, I owe you a dum-dum.
Yeah, there you go.
It's this little moment of, you know, quick celebration, and then we keep going.
Right. Which is a great point, and I'm gonna talk about that too. Like, I think that's fantastic, yes. Margaret.
So, at the beginning of the year, I really always stress that coding is something that you're going to make mistakes at. That almost nobody types something in and gets it right. In fact, people make so many mistakes that have an extra word, special word for it called debugging.
Yeah.
That's just the nature of coding. And I do let them know that at the beginning of the year, many of them are a little bit like really uncertain when they're with the IDE and the terminal and this, and a little bit confused. And I always do kind of stress to prepare them for that. And the other thing I do, and I know it's not possible for some teachers, that I do try to give them as much coding time in the classroom, particularly at the beginning.
Sure.
So that they're not feeling forced to stay up all night and try to debug, because I do firmly feel that the students in my school have so much pressure and so many APs, and if I put a really hard deadline on something and make them do it from home, they're going to end up copying from a friend.
Right.
And not really learning. So I really do try to stress that the important thing is that if you need a little extra time, talk to me. If you're stuck in something, talk to me. And the important thing is that you're learning something here.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And then depending on like your situation and what kind of a district you're in as to what accessibility students have outside of the classroom, maybe it is important to do all necessary work on the computer in the classroom and don't have expectations outside of the classroom. And it also could be like to tell a very long story short, motivation for students. If you have the opposite scenario where like a student is just an absolute rock star in your classroom and they're struggling elsewhere. I had that scenario where a student was in my class every day. I had him for third period and it was fantastic, one of my best students. And like the long story of that is like things that were going on in his personal life, but great in my class. And another teacher approached me and said, this student is never in my class. And she was all upset. And why doesn't he come to school? I said, I see him every day. Or every other day every other day. And she said, well, he never comes to my class. When do you have him for class? I have him first period. Okay, so what we found out is that he just didn't like the other class, but he loved my class, and it wasn't, I don't know. I mean, I didn't ask any questions. I just knew that like he didn't particularly take a liking to that class for any reason, but he really liked my class. So I sat him down and I said, here's the deal. Like, if you don't come to the other class, you don't get to use the computer in my class. And I think he resisted for maybe a class period or two, and he realized that like this is again like the long story of the long part of the story. He realized that this was his out. If he could learn these things, this was his way to success. So guess what? Started coming to school, started showing up for first period. So you could use it as a motivating factor as well. Yes.
Similar to encourage participation, what I do is I have a bell, like a front desk.
Yes.
And if a student says, "Oh, you missed an include or something," you get a ding. And also wakes up whoever is going to make the ding.
All right, that's awesome. You know, it'd be even greater if you get one of those horns and you give the old burr, 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 burr. That's great. I keep that open. I closed it for this, but I usually keep the air horn open on my computer so if something happens in the office, I just hit it. Aaron knows.
Sorry, goes, burr, 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 burr. When they don't get a ding, I missed the ding.
Yeah. Yep. So super quick, a motivating factor for computer science in general, what I used to do with my students is a lot of things have high barriers to entry. If you want to be a lawyer, you have to go to college, you have to go to a good college, you have to do well, you have to, you know, pass exams, you have to get into a good law school, but like with computer science, it's a set of skills that you can gain anywhere, anytime. And you can get gainful employment and you know, satisfactory employment and, you know, exceed even further. So I would always show my students like little quick videos of just how this could happen. It could be current events or something like that, or I would show, the progression of somebody who came out of nowhere and then created a company or something based on computer science, and that really motivated them. They were like, wow, like this can happen for me. I don't have to go to, you know, X college or do this or do that. Well, obviously I'm not saying you shouldn't go to college. I'm just saying you give them like hope, because not in reality, like not everybody's gonna go to college, right? Or something. So you can, that's something that I use as a motivating factor. Anybody have any last? All right, perfect. So we're right on schedule here. So sometimes it's more effective to show students an incorrect solution than a right one, right? So even if you do it intentionally and say, whether you tell them or not, put the solution on the board and then maybe have them debug it in real time. You know, that could be a great strategy that I used to use all the time. Like, especially like, you know, Scratch is primarily what I taught at the beginning of the semester in eighth grade, and I would love to do that. I would just sit there, my Hawaii friends know because I did it to them the other day. I'd just, you know, pull out a block where it needed to be or dissolve something, and we'd sit there for a while, and that kind of gets them to think, what's going on, what's wrong, why isn't it working? And you can do it kind of like that without having to go in, rerun, you just hit the green flag and whatnot. Yeah, so let students figure out your mistakes. And I think that whenever you're solving a problem, it's more beneficial than just giving them the problem. If you give them a problem that's absolutely correct. For example, when I was in third grade, I remember learning the multiplication tables. And I knew up to like the 12s or something by a certain point. And I don't remember if I ever realized what I was doing. If I realized like 5 times 5, like I was actually like computing something to get 25, I just knew visually when I looked at a 5 and then an X and a 5 that a 25 should go over here. Right? And then or even I could repeat it. What is 5 times 5? 25, right? But you could kind of get through those things without understanding what's going on. So if you show somebody the perfect solution, I don't think that's always the most effective way to educate. And encourage discussion and guessing. Again, same thing with the, you know, student gives me an answer 3, student gives me an answer 2. How did you come up with this? How did you come up with that? We're going to talk about it. And maybe you can help the students themselves connect dots and be their own support group. Effective feedback. So this is not feedback. You might want to use a loop instead here. Why? Okay. Design 3 out of 5. Again, why? Great. Why? Right? So those are essentially like advice and value judgments. So you might want to say like, all right, design, you got a 3 out of 5 because maybe you have too many steps where you could have condensed it down to something or extracted something out, or you know, maybe there's a better way to do this. It is correct, it does work, but maybe there's a better way to implement your code here. So what we've done for you as described in as demonstrated, check 50 and style 50. Check 50 is going to assess your correctness. Style 50 is going to assess the style for you. So what we've done is remove like 2/3 of your workload for grading, which gives you more time to spend on design, which also gives you more time to put special attention to students' work. So for example, by using CS50.me, when you know, student facing, the students have all of their work in a nice, neat place, and they can see their individual piece sets, and they can actually see comments that you put in, even line by line as you address it. And then you have the ability to do that via GitHub on your side, and you can kind of have a nice conversation. So that's a good way to give feedback. If you would like to Google at some point, Grant Wiggins did a great piece on the 7 keys to effective feedback. Out of these 7, you know, you can read through them here, but I think 5, 6, and 7 are probably the toughest. 5, timely, because if you have a lot of students, maybe the first thing that you grade, the first piece that you grade, you have all kinds of notes and things that you want to say to the students, but then you have 50 other or 75 others, so maybe it's a week and a half before you can get back to student 1 to maybe give them feedback, and they're gonna kind of be like, wait, what is this? I don't understand this, I don't even remember that. We're on to something else. So that again is great where the scenario of transferring comments in GitHub will come into play. Ongoing and consistent is a similar scenario. If you know the very first piece sets that you grade, you're really detailed and clear with the students because you have a lot of time to address it. But then once you get to like piece set 3, 4, 5, and then you're still grading piece set 2 and 3 possibly, if that's kind of how your workflow is, you don't have time, and you kind of like now all of a sudden you're just checking and going, checking and going, checking and going, and you're not giving that consistent and persistent feedback that you would like to. So it's key to be able to give these things to maintain consistency, et cetera, and provide timely feedback. So one of the cool things in GitHub is you can store saved replies for common errors that you know are either going to come up or that have come up. And for me, one of the most common errors was when I taught CSS. I would teach the students how to change the color in a background. And I would explain, okay, go ahead and do it, change the color of the background to green. And I would just look at the screens of the students, and half of them would be green and half of them would still be white, and half the hands go up. And when I first started teaching it, I would have to go over to the students' code and I'd look through it. What'd you do wrong? What'd you do wrong? And eventually what I realized is that, you know, for some reason, 8th graders don't put a G. When I say background, they don't hear the G. They think I'm saying back round. So eventually, when I would teach that, I would say, all right, you know, change the background, half the hands go up. Put a G, and I like this, so that was like my mental saved reply. I would just say to the students, put a G. I knew exactly what they were missing. So for each problem set, you know, best offer multiple pluses and multiple deltas. And common issues to look for are repetition of code, lack of clarity and more complexity than necessary. Obviously, you're going to have students that, you know, go above and beyond, and it's good in some cases. In other cases, maybe it's the simpler answer is the best answer. And that's what I have for you.